Side 4, The Mark of the Assassin by Daniel Silva, continuing on page 161. Delaroche paused and resumed walking when the dog finished. He glanced around to see if he was alone. Satisfied, he closed the ground between himself and Arbatov with a few quick steps. Arbatov, alarmed by the noise, turned around in time to see Delaroche arm raised. He swung down with brutal swiftness and struck Arbatov on the side of his neck, instantly shattering his spine. The old man collapsed. The dog barked wildly, thrashing about on his leash, which Arbatov still clutched in his hand. Delaroche reached inside Arbatov's coat and took his wallet. Street thugs don't kill with a single blow to the neck, he told himself. Only professionals do. Street thugs maul and bludgeon. He kicked Arbatov in the face several times and walked away. The rain fell harder. The barking of the dog faded into the wet night. Delaroche walked at a normal pace. He removed the cash and the credit cards from Arbatov's wallet and threw it into a flower bed bordering the footpath. In the pale yellow light of the street, he noticed blood on his right shoe. He wiped it away with old newspaper and caught a taxi back to his hotel. He still had time to make his train. He packed quickly and checked out. On the platform, waiting for the train, he threw Arbatov's credit cards in a rubbish bin. The carriage was crowded. He found a seat and ordered a sandwich and a beer from the porter. Then he pillowed his head on his leather coat and slept until the train arrived in Brest. Chapter 16, Washington, D.C. Susanna Dayton worked all Sunday afternoon from noon until 8 without a break, except to answer the door sometime late in the afternoon to take delivery of a pizza. Tom Logan, her editor at the Post, had demanded more, and she had found it. The piece was airtight. She had real estate and bank documents to support the most damaging charges. She had doubled and tripled human sources to support the others. No one mentioned in the piece would be able to question her reporting. The facts spoke for themselves, and Susanna had the facts. The day was spent writing. She worked at home because she wanted no distractions. The piece was dense with information. Numbers, names, dates, places, people. Susanna's challenge was to turn it into an interesting story. She opened with a brief sketch of her central character, James Beckwith, a young district attorney, a promising talent with no personal fortune, who could earn many times more in the private sector than he could in politics. Enter Mitchell Elliott, an immensely wealthy defense contractor and Republican benefactor. Stay in politics, Elliott told the young Beckwith, and leave the rest to me. Over the years, Elliott had enriched the Beckwiths through a number of real estate and other financial transactions. And the man who devised many of the schemes was Elliott's chief lawyer and Washington lobbyist, Samuel Braxton. The rest flowed from that premise. By 8 o'clock that evening, she had written a 4,000-word piece. She would show it to Tom Logan in the morning. Because of the serious nature of the charges, Logan would have to run it past the paper's managing editor and editor-in-chief. Then the lawyers would review the copy. She knew it was going to be a long and difficult couple of days. The piece lacked one final element: comment from the White House, Mitchell Elliott, and Samuel Braxton. She flipped through her Rolodex, found the first telephone number, and punched it in. Alatron Defense Systems. The voice was male, accentless, and vaguely military. This is Susanna Dayton of the Washington Post. I'd like to speak with Mitchell Elliott, please. I'm sorry, Ms. Dayton, but Mr. Elliott is unavailable at this time. I wonder if you could give him a message for me.
Certainly.
Do you have a pen?
Of course, Ms. Dayton. I would like Mr. Elliott to comment on the following information contained in the piece I'm preparing.
She spoke for 5 minutes. The man on the other end of the line never interrupted. She concluded the call was probably being recorded without her consent. Did you get all that?
Yes, Ms. Dayton.
And you'll pass it on to Mr. Elliott?
Certainly.
Good. Thank you very much. She hung up
and flipped through her Rolodex. She still had Paul Vandenberg's home number from her days at the White House. She punched in the number. Vandenberg answered the phone himself. "Mr. Vandenberg, this is Susanna Dayton. I'm a reporter for..."
"I know who you are, Miss Dayton. I don't appreciate being disturbed at home. Now, what can I do for you?"
"I wonder if you would like to comment on the following information contained in the piece I've prepared for the Post." Once again, Suzanne spoke for 5 minutes without interruption. When she finished, Vandenberg said,
"Why don't you fax me a copy of the article so I can review the charges more carefully?"
"I'm afraid I can't do that, Mr. Vandenberg."
"Then I'm afraid I have nothing to say to you, Ms. Dayton, except that you have produced a piece of shoddy journalism that need not be graced with a comment."
Susanna jotted down the quote on her notepad.
"Good evening, Ms. Dayton."
The line went dead. Susanna flipped through her Rolodex and found Samuel Braxton's home number. She was reaching for the telephone when it rang.
"This is Sam Braxton."
"Boy, word traveled fast."
"I understand you're about to publish a piece that libels and defames Mitchell Elliott and myself. I want to make you aware of the consequences of your actions."
"Why don't you let me read the allegations to you before you threaten me with a lawsuit?"
"I've been given a summary of the charges, Miss Dayton. Do you intend to publish this account in tomorrow's paper?"
"We haven't decided."
"I'll take that as a no."
Susanna covered the mouthpiece and murmured, "Fuck you, Sam Braxton, you pompous bastard."
"Why don't we meet in the morning and discuss the allegations?"
Susanna hesitated. If she discussed legal issues with Braxton without a Post lawyer at her side, Tom Logan would have her head. Still, she wanted Braxton on the record.
"Do yourself a favor, Ms. Dayton. What harm can it do?"
"Where?"
"Breakfast at the Four Seasons in Georgetown. 8 o'clock.
See you then."
"Good night, Miss Dayton."
Susanna had one more call to make. Elizabeth Osborne. She was about to publish a devastating piece about the most powerful man in her firm. Elizabeth deserved a heads up. She dialed.
"Hello?" "Hello, Elizabeth. Listen, I think we need to talk."
Mark Callahan was sitting in the library of the Kalorama House, turning the knobs on a bank of sophisticated audio equipment, when the call from Colorado Springs came through. Callahan knew more about the allegations contained in the piece than anyone except Susanna Dayton. He had bugged her phone at Post headquarters downtown on 15th Street. He had bugged her phone at home. He planted bugs in her living room and her bedroom. He listened to her eat. He listened to her sleep. He listened to her talking to her dog. He listened to her fuck a television reporter after dinner at the Georgetown restaurant in 1789. He broke into her home regularly and raided her computer files. A former NSA codebreaker, also employed by Mitchell Elliott, had cracked her childish encryption cipher, allowing Callahan to read her files at will. He was missing one thing, the finished product. Elliott said, "Get inside her house as quickly as you can. We need to know exactly what we're dealing with."
"Yes, sir."
"And do it yourself, Mark. I don't want any fuck-ups on this one."
Callahan hung up the phone. He returned his attention to his equipment. He turned up the audio levels on the transmitters inside Susanna Dayton's home. Something caught his attention. He pulled on a black leather jacket and rushed out into the night. He drove rapidly across Northwest Washington, from Kalorama into Georgetown, and parked behind the surveillance van on Volta Place. He rapped his knuckle on the rear door, and the technician let him inside. 2 minutes later, he spotted Susanna Dayton exiting Pomander Walk, dressed in an anorak and lycra leggings, her dog at her side. Callahan waited until she had vanished from sight. He jumped out of the van, crossed Volta Place, and entered Pomander Walk. He had made his own copy of her front door key. A few seconds later, he was inside. Susanna crossed Wisconsin Avenue and ran eastward along P Street. It was late and dark, and she had a running date with Elizabeth in the morning, but she had been cooped up inside her little house all day long, and she needed to do something to relieve the stress. Her neck ached from staring at the computer monitor. Her eyes burned, but after a mile or so, she felt sweat break beneath her turtleneck. The magic of the run took hold, and the tension of the day slowly leaked from her body. She pushed herself harder, flying over the red brick sidewalk of P Street, past large, brightly lit townhouses. Carson's paws clicked rhythmically beside her. She passed a 7-Eleven, then a small coffee shop. Jack and his new wife were perched atop two stools in the window, talking closely. She stared at them like an idiot as she ran past. Jack looked up, and his gaze met hers. Then his wife spotted her. She turned away, mortified, and ran faster. Idiot! Fucking idiot! Why didn't you look away? And what the hell were they doing in Georgetown anyway? That was the whole point of Jack moving to Bethesda, so they wouldn't be bumping into each other all the time. God, why couldn't she just look away? Why did she have to stare through the glass like a schoolgirl with a crush? And why was her heart beating out of control? The answer to that was simple. She still loved Jack, and she always would. Tears filled her eyes, blurring her vision. She ran faster. Carson struggled to keep pace. She pounded her feet savagely over the bricks. God, why did he have to be sitting there? Fuck you, Jack! Fuck you! She didn't see the tree root that had raised a portion of the sidewalk. Didn't see the jagged edge of brick that had been forced upward. She felt a sudden pain in her ankle, saw the ground rushing up at her in the darkness. Susanna lay on the ground, eyes closed, gasping for breath. She felt as though she had been kicked in the stomach by a horse. She tried to open her eyes, but could not. Finally, she felt someone shaking her shoulder, calling her name. She opened her eyes and saw Jack kneeling over her. Susanna, are you all right? Can you hear me? She closed her eyes again and said, what the hell are you doing in Georgetown? Sharon and I had a dinner engagement. Jesus, I didn't know I had to call and notify you first. No, you just startled me, that's all. You remember Sharon, don't you? She was standing behind Jack, stunning in a black cocktail dress and short black coat that showed off a pair of extraordinary legs. She was criminally skinny. The front of her coat was unbuttoned, revealing a pair of large, rounded breasts. She was Jack's type. Blonde, blue eyes, big breasts, no brains. She said, I wish I could say it's a pleasure to see you, Sharon, but I'd be lying. We're going your way. Why don't you let us give you a lift? No, thanks. I'd rather be left on the street for dead. Jack reached down and took hold of her hand. Carson growled deep in his throat. It's all right, Carson. He's evil but harmless. She got to her feet. There's a cab. Be useful, Jack. Get him to stop for me. Jack stepped out into the street. He flagged down the cab and it pulled to the curb. Susanna limped over and climbed in the back, followed by the dog. See you around, Jack, Sharon. She closed the door and the cab drove off. She slumped down in the back seat, clutching her ankle. Her head leaned back against the cold leather of the seat. She sobbed quietly. Carson licked her hand. God, why did she have to see me like that? Of all times and places, why like that? The cab stopped at Volta Place and Palmander Walk. She reached inside the front pouch of the anorak, took out a $5 bill, and handed it to the driver. Need any help? He asked. No, I'll be fine, thanks. The computer was still on when Mark Callahan climbed the staircase and entered the second floor bedroom that Susanna used as a study. He sat down, removed a floppy from his jacket pocket, and inserted it into the disk drive of the desktop. He knew her system well now, the directories where she kept her notes and copy. He found the slug for the article and clicked on it. The encryption software asked for a password. Callahan provided it, and the story appeared on the screen. Callahan did not bother to read it. He could do that later when he had more time. He closed the file again and typed in the command to copy it to the floppy drive. Once again, the encryption software asked for the password. Once again, Callahan provided it. Since he was already inside the house, he decided to use the opportunity to gather additional intelligence. Callahan had followed the woman on several runs, and they never lasted less than 30 minutes. He had plenty of time. Three new notepads lay on the desk next to the keyboard. He opened the cover on the first. The pages were filled with notes in Susanna Dayton's looping left-handed scrawl. He removed a micro camera from his pocket, switched on the desk lamp, and started shooting. He was halfway through the second notepad when he heard the scrape of a key being shoved into the barrel of the front door lock. He cursed silently, switched off the light, and drew a silenced 9mm pistol from the waistband of his trousers. Susanna's right ankle hurt like hell. She closed the door behind her and sat down on the couch in the living room. She removed her shoe and her sock and inspected the injury. The ankle was swollen and purple. She limped into the kitchen, filled a Ziploc bag with ice, and took a bottle of beer from the refrigerator. The pain reliever was in the bathroom medicine cabinet. She limped up the stairs and hobbled down the hall, leaning against the banister for support. She entered the bathroom, placed the beer on the edge of the sink, and opened the medicine cabinet. She found the pain reliever and washed down two tablets with the beer. She closed the cabinet door. In the mirror, she saw the reflection of a man standing behind her. Susanna opened her mouth to scream. A gloved hand closed around her mouth, smothering her cries. "Shut up, you fucking bitch, or I'll kill you," the man said through clenched teeth. Susanna only struggled more. She put her weight on her injured ankle, raised her left foot, and dragged it down his shin, just the way she had been taught in her urban self-defense class. The man groaned in pain and loosened his grip. She pivoted to her right and struck backward with her right elbow. The blow landed on her attacker's cheekbone. He relaxed his grip and she broke away. She stumbled into the hallway, then into the study. Reaching for the telephone, she realized the attacker had tampered with her computer and with her notebooks. She picked up the receiver. The man appeared in the doorway, pointing a gun at her face. "Put down the fucking telephone." "Who are you?" "Put down the telephone now and I won't hurt you." Carson charged up the stairs, barking wildly. He crouched in the hallway, baring his teeth at the intruder. The man calmly raised the gun and shot the dog twice. The silenced weapon emitted virtually no sound. Carson yelped once, then went quiet. "You bastard! You fucking bastard! Who the fuck are you? Did Elliot send you? Tell me, goddammit! Did Mitchell Elliot send you?" "Put the phone down, now." She looked down and punched the 9 and the 1. The first shot struck her head before she could enter the last digit. She fell backward, still clutching the receiver, still conscious. She looked up. The man stood over her and pointed the gun at her head once more. "Not in the face," she pleaded. "Please, God, don't shoot me in the face." His mask of rage softened for an instant. He lowered the gun a few degrees, the barrel pointed at her chest. She closed her eyes. The gun emitted two brief bursts of sound. She felt one brief instant of excruciating pain, then a flash of brilliant light, then only darkness. Callahan reached down, removed the receiver from her grasp, and replaced it in the cradle. The kill had been quick, but it had not been completely silent. He needed to work quickly. The police would tear the place apart. If they discovered evidence the woman was under surveillance, there was a chance they could connect the slaying to Elliot. The cleanup job took less than 5 minutes. As he walked out the front door, Callahan held the notepads, the two room bugs, the bug from the telephone, her handbag, and her laptop computer. He headed out Ponander Walk, crossed Folter Place, and climbed into the surveillance van. He'd return later for his car. As he sped away, he punched Mitchell Elliott's private number into a cellular phone. "I'm afraid we have a bit of a problem, Mr. Elliott. I'll call you on a secure line in 5 minutes. Callahan severed the connection and threw the phone against the windshield.
God damn it. Why did she come back early? Fucking bitch.
Chapter 17. Brele, France. Delaroche concluded he needed a woman. He reached that judgment after reviewing the disc a second time, this time on his desktop computer at the college in Brele.
Two of the three remaining targets were known womanizers.
Delaroche knew their routines, knew where they ate and drank, knew where they did their hunting. Still, getting close to these targets would be difficult. A woman would make it easier. Delaroche needed a woman. He had one day to spend in Brele. When he finished with the dossiers, he went for a bicycle ride. The weather was good, clear for November, light winds from the sea. He knew it would be a long time before he would ride again, so he pushed himself hard. He pedaled inland several miles into the soft wooded hills of the Finisterre, then down to the sea again. He paused at the ruins on the Pointe de Saint-Mathieu, then headed north along the coast back to Brele. The early afternoon he devoted to preparation. He cleaned and oiled his two best guns, a Beretta 9mm and the Glock, and checked and rechecked the firing mechanisms and the silencers. He had a third gun that he kept strapped to his ankle in a Velcro holster, a small Browning automatic designed to fit in a woman's purse. In the event a gun was not appropriate, he would carry a knife, a stout 6-inch double-bladed knife with automatic release. Next he gathered his false passports, French, Italian, Dutch, Spanish, Swedish, Egyptian, and American, and saw to his finances. He had the 200,000 francs from the gallery in Paris, and in Zurich he would collect a $500,000. It was more than enough to finance the job. He went out while it still was light and walked to the village. He bought bread from the boulangerie and sausage, cheese, and pâté from Mademoiselle Pochet. Didier and his friends were drinking wine at the café. He gestured for Delaroche to join them, and uncharacteristically, Delaroche agreed. He ordered more wine and ate bread and olives with them until the sun was gone. That evening, he had a simple meal outside on the stone terrace overlooking the sea. He had agreed to kill three more men in 4 weeks. Only a fool would accept such an assignment. He would be lucky to survive it. Even if he did, he might never be able to return to Brele. Delaroche had always been dispassionate about killing, but for the first time in longer than he could remember, he felt an excitement rising within him. It was not unlike the feeling he had when he was 16, the night he killed for the first time. He cleared away his dishes and washed them in the sink. Then, for the next hour, he systematically worked his way through the cottage and burned anything that suggested he ever existed. Delaroche took the morning train from Brest to Paris and a midday train from Paris to Zurich. He arrived 1 hour before his bank closed. He left his small grip in a locker at the station and converted some of his French francs at a bureau de change. He walked along a glittering street lined with brightly lit exclusive shops. In a Gucci boutique, he used cash to purchase a simple black attaché case. He told the clerk he did not require a bag, and a moment later he was walking along the sidewalk again, the attaché dangling from his right arm. It was snowing lightly by the time he reached the austere front entrance of his bank. The only clue as to the nature of the establishment was a small gold plaque beside the door. Delaroche pressed the buzzer and waited while the security guard inspected him through the lens of the video camera mounted over the door. The door lock snapped open, and he was led inside a small, secure entrance room. He picked up a black telephone and announced he had an appointment with Herr Becker. Becker arrived a moment later, immaculately dressed and polished, shorter than Delaroche, by a bald head that shone in the fluorescent light. Delaroche followed him down a silent, dimly lit, beige-carpeted hall. Becker led him into another secure room and locked the door behind them. Delaroche felt claustrophobic. Becker opened a small vault and withdrew the money.
Delaroche smoked while Becker counted it out for him. The entire transaction took less than 10 minutes. Delaroche signed the receipt for the money, and Becker helped him stack it neatly inside the case. In the entrance room, Becker looked out at the street and said, "One can never be too careful, Monsieur Delaroche. There are thieves about." "Thank you, Herr Becker. I think I can handle myself. Have a pleasant evening."
"Same to you, Monsieur Delaroche."
Delaroche did not want to walk a long distance with the money, so he took a taxi back to the station. He collected his bag from the locker and purchased a first-class ticket on an overnight train to Amsterdam. Delaroche arrived at Amsterdam's Centraal Station early the following morning. He moved quickly through the crowded hall, eyes red-rimmed from a night of fitful sleep, and stepped outside into the bright sunlight. The sight of the bicycles struck him, thousands of them, row upon row. Delaroche took a taxi to the Hotel Ambassade in the Central Canal Ring and checked in as Señor Armiñana, a Spanish businessman. He spent an hour on the telephone, varying his languages in case the hotel operator might be listening, speaking in the coded lexicon of the criminal underground. He slept for a time, and by late morning he was seated in the window of a smoky cafe a short distance from his hotel. The bookstore was there, across a busy square. It had developed a well-deserved reputation for snobbery, for it specialized in literature and philosophy, and refused to stock commercial fiction nor thrillers. The hotel clerk said the manager once physically removed a woman who dared to ask for the new book by a famous American romance writer. It was a perfect place for Astrid. Twice he caught a glimpse of her, stacking books in the front window, giving advice to a male customer, who was clearly more interested in her than in any book she might be recommending. Astrid had that effect on men, always did. It was why Delaroche came to Amsterdam in the first place. She was born Astrid Meyer in the town of Kassel near the East German border. When her father walked out on the family in 1967, her mother abandoned his name and reclaimed her own, which was Lisbeth Vogel. After the divorce, Lisbeth settled in a lakeside cottage in the mountains of Switzerland, outside Bern. It was familiar territory. Late in the war, in July 1944, her family fled Germany and sought refuge in a nearby village. It was there, alone in the mountains with her mother, that Astrid Meyer began her lifelong fascination with her grandfather, Kurt Vogel. A heavy smoker his entire life, Vogel died of lung cancer in 1949, 10 years before Astrid was born. In the end, his wife Gertrude had tried to bring him down from the mountains, but Vogel believed the alpine air held his salvation, and he died at home, gasping for breath. Trudy Vogel knew next to nothing of her husband's wartime work, but what she did know, she told to Lisbeth, and Lisbeth told to Astrid. He had given up a promising legal career in 1935 to join the Abwehr, the German Secret Service. He had been a close associate of the chief of the Abwehr, Wilhelm Canaris, who was executed for treason by the Nazis in April 1945. He had deceived Trude for years, telling her that he was Canaris's legal counsel. But late in the war, he admitted the truth. He had recruited agents and sent them to England to spy on the British. Lisbeth remembered the night. Her father had moved the family to Bavaria because Berlin was no longer safe. She remembered her father arriving at the house very late, remembered his presence in her bedroom, framed against the faint light of the open doorway. Later, she remembered the sound of her mother and father talking softly in the kitchen, and the smell of her father's supper. And then she heard the sound of dishes shattering, the sound of her mother gasping. She and her twin sister, Nicole, crawled to the top of the stairs and looked down. Below, in the kitchen, they saw their parents and two men wearing the black uniforms of the SS. One man they did not recognize. The other was Heinrich Himmler, the most powerful man in Germany after Adolf Hitler. For years, Lisbeth Vogel believed her father had been a Nazi, an ally of Himmler and the SS, a war criminal who had chosen to die in the mountains of Switzerland rather than face justice in his homeland. Her mother, she concluded, secretly believed the same. When her mother was dead, Lisbeth told the story to Astrid, and Astrid grew up believing her grandfather was a Nazi. Then, on an afternoon in October 1970, a man telephoned the cottage and asked if he could visit. His name was Werner Ubricht, and he had worked with Kurt Vogel at the Abwehr during the war. He said he knew the truth about Vogel's work. Lisbeth told him to come. He arrived an hour later, gaunt, pale as baker's flour, leaning heavily on a cane, a neat black patch over one eye. They walked for a time, Werner Ubricht, Lisbeth, and Astrid, and then sat on the grassy bank of the lake and drank coffee from a thermos bottle. Despite the snap of autumn in the air, Ulrich's face was bathed in sweat from the exertion. He rested for a time, sipping his coffee, and then told them the story. Kurt Vogel was no Nazi. He hated them with a passion. He came to the Abwehr on condition he not be forced to join the party, and Canaris had been more than happy to grant him his wish. He was not an in-house legal counsel to Canaris. He was an agent runner, and a damned good one at that. Meticulous, brilliant, ruthless in his own way. One of his agents in Britain was a woman. Together they learned the most important secret of the war, the time and place of the invasion. They also learned that the British were engaged in a massive deception to conceal the truth. But in February 1944, Hitler fired Canaris and placed the Abwehr under the control of Himmler and the SS. Vogel kept his information to himself and joined the anti-Hitler plotters of the Schwarze Kapelle, the Black Orchestra. When the July 20 coup attempt ended in disaster, many of the Schwarze Kapelle plotters were arrested and executed. Vogel fled to Switzerland. Lisbeth's eyes were damp when Ulbricht finished the story. She stared at the lake, watching the wind ripple the surface. "Who was the other man who came with Himmler to my mother's house?" she asked. "He was Walter Schellenberg, a very senior officer in the SD. He took over the Abwehr when Canaris was fired. Your father deceived him about the invasion." "The woman who was his agent?" Lisbeth asked, voice trailing off. "Was he in love with her? Mother always thought he was in love with someone else." "It was a long time ago." "Tell me the truth, Herr Ulbricht." "Yes, he loved her very much."
"What was her name?"
"Her name was Anna Katharina von Steiner. Your father forced her to become an agent. She never came back from England." Astrid's obsessive fascination with her grandfather began that afternoon. Her own grandfather, an ally of Wilhelm Canaris, a brave Schwarze Kapelle resister who tried to rid Germany of Hitler. In the attic she found a chest of his things her mother had saved, old law books and a few ancient photographs, brittle with age, some clothing. She studied them for hours on end. When she was old enough, she even imitated his appearance, the spiky hair that looked as though he had cut it himself, the pebble-lensed eyeglasses, the dour undertaker's suits. She tried to imagine the agent named Anna Katharina von Steiner, the woman he had been in love with. In her grandfather's papers, Astrid could find no trace of her, so she painted a portrait of Anna in her imagination, beautiful, brave, ruthless, violent. When she was 18, Astrid returned to Germany to attend university in Munich and immediately became involved in leftist politics. She believed Nazis were still running Germany. She believed the Americans were occupiers. She believed industrialists had enslaved workers. She imagined what her grandfather, the great Kurt Vogel, would have done. He would join the resistance, of course. In 1979, she gave up her studies at the university and joined the Red Army faction. The leaders said she would have to give up her real name and choose a nom de guerre. She chose Anna Steiner, and vanished into the world of terrorism. She was living on a houseboat in the Prinzengracht. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, she walked out of the bookstore, freed her bicycle from the rack, and set out across the square. Delaroche signaled the waiter for a check. She walked for a time, pushing the bike, obviously in no hurry. Delaroche trailed softly after her. She had changed little in the years since he had seen her last. She was tall and vaguely awkward, with beautiful but graceless legs and long hands that seemed forever in search of a comfortable resting place. Her face was from another time and place, luminous white skin, broad cheekbones, a large nose, eyes the color of mountain lake water. Her hair always changed with her mood and her politics, but now, in early middle age, it had returned to its natural state, long, blonde, held back by a plain black clasp. He followed her north along the Kaisersgracht. She crossed the canal at Rehestraat, then headed north again along the Prinzengracht. She passed into the shadow of the Westerkerk, the site of Rembrandt's unmarked grave. Delaroche increased his pace, closing the distance between them. Hearing his footfalls, she spun quickly, hand reaching inside her handbag, alarm on her face. Delaroche took her gently by the arm. "It's only me, Astrid. Don't be afraid." Krista was 45 feet long, with a wheelhouse aft, a slender prow, and a fresh coat of green and white paint. It was tied up next to a boxy barge, and to get aboard, Astrid and Delaroche had to scamper across the neighbor's aft deck. The inside was clean and surprisingly large, complete with a galley kitchen, a salon, and a bedroom in the prow. The weak light of late afternoon trickled through a pair of skylights and a row of portholes along the gunwale. Delaroche sat in the salon, watching Astrid as she busied herself with coffee in the galley. They spoke Dutch, for she was passing herself off as a divorcee from Rotterdam and didn't want the neighbors to hear her chattering in German. Like all Amsterdammers, she was obsessive about her bicycle. She had lost 4 to thieves since settling in the city. She told Delaroche about the day she was strolling along the single and came upon a man selling used bicycles. Among the stock, Astrid spotted one of her missing bikes. She told the man it was hers and demanded he give it back. He said she was crazy. She looked beneath the seat and found the name tag she had placed there. He said she was a liar. She grabbed hold of the bicycle and announced she was taking it back. He tried to stop her. She lashed sideways with an elbow, breaking his larynx, and then shattered his jaw with a vicious roundhouse kick. She picked up the bike and strolled away to a chorus of cheers, the heroine of every Amsterdammer who had ever lost a bike to the black market. She carried the coffee to the salon and sat down across from Delaroche. She removed the clasp from her hair and allowed it to fall about her shoulders. She was a stunningly attractive woman who had learned to conceal her beauty in order to blend into her surroundings. For a moment, he enjoyed just looking at her. "So, what brings you to Amsterdam, Jean-Paul? Business or pleasure?"
"You, Astrid. I need your help."
She shook her head slowly and lit a cigarette.
Delaroche anticipated she might be unwilling to work with him. She had killed often, and she had paid a very high price. A life spent underground on the run from every secret service and police force in the West. She was more settled than she had ever been, and now Delaroche was asking her to undo it all.
"I've been out of the game for a long time, Jean-Paul. I'm tired of killing. I don't enjoy it like you do."
"I don't enjoy it. I do it because I'm paid money, and it's all I know how to do.
You were very good at it once." "I did it because I believed in something. There's a difference. And look at what it's gotten me," she said, gesturing at her surroundings. "Oh, I suppose it could be worse. I could be in Damascus. Jesus, that was awful."
Delaroche had heard she'd spent 2 years hiding in Syria, courtesy of Hafiz al-Assad and his intelligence service, and another 2 years in Libya as the guest of Muammar Gaddafi. I'm offering you a way out, a chance to put it all behind you, and enough money to live comfortably somewhere quiet for the rest of your life. You want to hear more? She crushed out her cigarette and immediately lit another. Damn you. He rose and said, I'll take that as a yes. How many people are we going to kill? I'll be back in a half hour. He went back to his hotel, packed and checked out. 30 minutes later, he was climbing down the companionway of the Krista, clutching his small overnight bag and a nylon case holding his laptop computer. They sat in the salon again. Delaroche hunched over his computer, Astrid perched atop an ottoman. Delaroche went through the targets one by one. Astrid sat still as a statue, legs folded beneath her, one long hand cupping her chin, another holding a cigarette. She said nothing, asked no questions, for like Delaroche, she had the gift of a flawless memory. If you help me, I will pay you $1 million, Delaroche said at the conclusion of the briefing. And I will help you settle somewhere safe and a little more pleasant than Damascus. Who's the contractor? I don't know. She raised an eyebrow. That's not like you, Jean-Paul. They must be paying you a great deal of money. She drew on the cigarette and blew a slender stream of smoke at the ceiling. Take me to dinner. I'm hungry. They had been lovers once, a long time ago, when Delaroche assisted the Red Army faction with a particularly difficult assassination. They went back to the Krista after dining in a small French restaurant overlooking the Herrengracht. Delaroche lay on the bed. Astrid sat down next to him and silently undressed. It had been many months since she had brought a man to her bed, and she took him very quickly the first time. Then she lit candles, and they smoked cigarettes and drank wine as rain rattled on the skylight above their bodies. She made love to him a second time, very slowly, drawing his body into her long arms and legs, touching him as though he were made of crystal. Astrid liked to be on top. Astrid liked to be in control. Astrid trusted no one, especially her lovers. For a long time she lay pressed against his body, kissing his mouth, staring into his eyes. Then she rose onto her knees, legs straddling his body, and it was as if Delaroche was no longer there. She toyed with her hair. She stroked the nipples of her small, upturned breasts. Then her eyes closed and her head rolled back. She pleaded with him to come inside her. When he did, she convulsed several times, then fell forward onto his chest, her body damp with sweat. After a moment, she rolled onto her back and watched rain running over the skylight. Promise me one thing, Jean-Paul Delaroche, she said. Promise me you won't kill me when you're finished with me. I promise I won't kill you. She rose onto her elbow, looked into his eyes, and kissed his mouth. Have you seen Arbatov lately? Yes, in Roscoff a few days ago. How is he? She asked. Same as ever, Delaroche said. Chapter 18, Washington, D.C. Elizabeth Osborne waited on the corner of 34th and M Streets, jogging in place, blowing on her hands against the cold morning air. She looked at her watch. Susanna was 5 minutes late. She had many faults, but tardiness was not one of them. She walked across the street to a payphone and punched in Susanna's home number. The answering machine picked up. Susanna, it's Elizabeth. Pick up if you're there. I'm waiting for you on the corner. I'll give you a few more minutes, then I have to get going. I'll try you at work. She dialed Susanna's desk at the post. Her voicemail picked up. Elizabeth hung up without leaving a message. She looked up 34th Street, but saw no sign of Susanna or Carson. She called home and checked her machine to see if Susanna had left a message there. The answering machine told her she had one message. She punched the access code, but it was only Max telling her a lunch meeting had been canceled. She hung up, thinking, "Damn it, where the hell is she?" She thought of the phone call from Susanna last night. She was about to break a big story about Mitchell Elliott and Samuel Braxton. Maybe she was on the phone, working the story. Maybe she was talking to her editors. She turned and jogged up 34th Street. At Volta Place, she turned right and then made another right into Pomander Walk. She bounded up the steps to Susanna's house and rang the bell. There was no answer. She hammered on the wooden door with the side of her fist. Again there was no answer and no sound from within the house. Carson was ever vigilant. He usually started barking before Elizabeth knocked on the door. If the dog were inside, he'd be barking his head off. She turned around and saw lights burning inside Harry Scanlon's house. She crossed the walkway and knocked on the door. Scanlon answered in his bathrobe. "I'm sorry to bother you, Harry, but Susanna and I were supposed to go for a run, and she stood me up. It's just not like her. I'm worried. Do you still have her key?" "Sure. Hang on a sec." Scanlon disappeared into the house and came back a moment later with a single key. "I'll give you a hand," he said. They went back to Susanna's front door. Scanlon shoved the key into the lock and pushed open the door. Elizabeth called out, "Susanna!" There was no answer. She looked around the living room and the kitchen. Everything seemed normal. She started up the stairs, calling Susanna's name, Scanlon behind her. When she reached the landing, she saw the dog. "Oh, God! Susanna! Susanna!" She stepped over the body of the dog and looked in the bathroom. The white tile floor was covered with glass where a beer bottle had fallen and shattered. Elizabeth walked a few more steps down the hall and looked into the study. She turned away and screamed. Elizabeth sat on the front steps of Harry Scanlon's house, a woolen blanket wrapped around her shoulders. A half-dozen Metropolitan Police cruisers, red and blue lights flashing, choked Volta Place. The crime scene truck had arrived, and the technicians were pouring over the inside of Susanna's house. She tried to call Michael, but he had not answered his phone. She left an emergency message with the operator and Harry Scanlon's number. She thought, "Damn it, Michael, I need you." Elizabeth pulled the blanket about her tightly, but the shaking wouldn't stop. She closed her eyes, but she saw Susanna's shattered body sprawled on the floor, and she saw the blood. God, so much blood! She realized someone was calling her name. She opened her eyes and saw a tall, fair-skinned African-American with striking green eyes standing before her. His police shield hung from the pocket of his blue, double-breasted suit coat. "Mrs. Osborne, I'm Detective Richardson, homicide. I understand you discovered the body?" "Yes, I did." "What time?" "Between 7:15 and 7:20, I believe." "You knew the victim?" Elizabeth thought. The victim? Susanna had already been robbed of her name. Now she was just the victim. "We were best friends, Detective. I've known her for 20 years. We were supposed to go running this morning. When she didn't show up, I came looking for her. I got the key from the neighbor and went inside." "Anything look out of the ordinary to you?" "Except for her body, no." "I'm sorry, Mrs. Osborne. Where did she work?" "She was a reporter for the Washington Post." "I thought the name sounded familiar. Worked at the White House for a while, right? Used to be on the Round Table show on TV. Elizabeth nodded. "This may sound like a strange question, but do you know anyone that would want to kill her?" "Not a soul." "Anything unusual going on in her life?" "No." "Any angry boyfriends,
jilted lovers. Elizabeth shook her head. Husband? He's remarried. How's their relationship? I work with him, Detective. He's a partner at my firm. He's a shit, but he's not a murderer. We can't find a purse. Did she carry one? Yes. She always left it on the kitchen counter. It's not there. Who did this? Impossible to say. Looks like someone was inside the house and she surprised him. She had jogging clothes on, but one of her shoes had been removed. Looks like she may have twisted her ankle. Dog was wearing a leash. So they shot her. A lot of people in this town would rather kill someone than leave a witness behind who could identify them later. He said this matter-of-factly. He reached out and put a hand on her shoulder. I'm very sorry, Mrs. Osborne. Here's my card. If you think of anything else, let me know. Elizabeth heard the telephone ringing inside the house. Harry Scanlon came to the door, eyes red. It's Michael, he said. Elizabeth rose and walked inside, unsteady on her feet. Michael, come home quickly. I need you. What happened? Why are you at Harry's? Susanna's dead. Someone shot her in her house. I found her. Oh, God, Michael. Her voice choked with tears. Please come home, Michael. Please hurry. Stay there. I'll come get you. No, meet me at home. I need to walk. I need some air. She looked out the window and saw Susanna's body, wrapped in a white sheet, being taken from the house on a stretcher. She had maintained her composure until then, but the sight of Susanna like that broke down the last of her strength. Elizabeth, are you there? Elizabeth, talk to me. They're just taking her away. Oh, God, poor Susanna. I just keep thinking about what she must have gone through before she died. I can't stop thinking about it. Get out of there. Go home. It will make you feel a little better. Trust me. Hurry. I will. She hung up the telephone. Scanlon was holding a floppy disk. Well, I guess she won't be needing this. He paused, his eyes filling with tears. God, I can't believe I said that. What is it? Scanlon explained their system, how Susanna always made extra copies of her work and left them through his door slot. She was paranoid about it. I know. In law school, she kept her papers in the refrigerator because she read somewhere that refrigerators could withstand fire. Elizabeth smiled at the memory. God, I miss her so much. I can't believe this is happening. Scanlon laid the disk on the kitchen counter. I found it when I came home last night. She must have slipped it through my door when she went out for her run. Funny, I always told her she was a fool to run at night, but she got killed in her own home. Elizabeth thought about the call from Susanna last night. She had been working on an important story all day. Whatever she was writing was probably on that disk. Elizabeth said, "Can I have that?" "Sure, but you will never be able to read it." "Why?" "Because she used encryption software. Like I told you, she was paranoid about people reading her stuff." "You don't know the password?" "No, she never told me. I would have thought she'd tell you." Elizabeth shook her head. "What about her editors at the Post?" "No way. She distrusted everyone, especially the people she worked with." "Let me have it," Elizabeth said. "I have a friend who knows something about these things." Elizabeth showed Michael the disk as they lay in bed, surrounded by tousled linen. Michael lit a cigarette and turned the disk over in his hand. Elizabeth laid her head on his tan stomach, trailing a finger through the patch of dark hair at the center of his chest. She felt guilty about making love at a time like this. When he came home, she wanted to be close to him. She wanted to hold him and never let him out of her sight. She was frightened, scared to death by what had happened to her friend.
and she was afraid to let go of him. She held him. She kissed his lips and his eyes and his nose. She undressed him and made love to him slowly, gently, as if she never wanted it to end. Now she lay close to him, watching rain streaming down the bedroom windows.
Harry says it's encrypted.
That's not a problem. All we need to do is figure out the keyword.
How do you intend to do that?
People are lazy. They use birth dates, addresses, all sorts of words and numbers that they can remember easily. You know more about Susanna than anyone alive.
Do you need special software?
I have it on my computer.
Let's go.
They put on bathrobes and walked down the hall to Michael's study. Michael sat down at the desk. Elizabeth stood behind him, hands draped over his shoulders.
Birthday?
November 17th, 1957. Michael typed in the numerical version. 11-17-57. The screen read, "Access denied. Incorrect password." Michael said, "Birth date backward." The computer made the same response. "Address. Address backward. Telephone number. Telephone number backward. Work phone. Work phone backward. First name. First name backward. Middle name. Middle name backward. Last name. Last name backward."
Elizabeth said, "This could take forever."
"Not forever.
I thought you said it was going to be easy."
"I said it wouldn't be a problem. Parents' names?
Maria and Carmen."
"Maria and Carmen?"
"She's Italian."
"She was Italian." Michael worked steadily for the next 2 hours. He learned more about Susanna's life than he ever thought possible. Boyfriends, hometown, bank, favorite movie, favorite book. He tried them all, forward, backward, and sideways, and nothing worked.
"What was the dog's name?"
"Carson."
"Why Carson?"
Elizabeth smiled. "Because she was an insomniac, and she loved The Tonight Show." Michael typed, "Carson." Nothing. He tried Johnny. Nothing. He tried Doc and Ed. Nothing. She had the last two shows on tape. She watched them 100 times. "Who was on the last show?"
"It was just Johnny, remember? He just talked to the audience."
"What about the show before?"
"Bette Midler. Jesus, she was crazy about Bette Midler."
Michael typed Bette. Nothing. Midler. Nothing. He typed them backward. Nothing. He slammed his palm on the desk.
"Move out of the way," Elizabeth said.
She leaned over his shoulder, typed "The Rose," and struck the enter key. The computer hesitated for a few seconds, and then the last thing Susanna Dayton ever wrote appeared on the screen. Michael said, "Jesus Christ." Chapter 19, Amsterdam. The houseboat on the Prinsengracht had taken on the appearance of a military operations room. Villaroche briefly considered returning to Braille, but it was a village, with a village's inclination to gossip, and he knew the presence of a tall, blonde woman would arouse unwelcome interest among Didier and his cohorts. Besides, the Christa provided a relaxing and secluded atmosphere to plan the assassinations. On the walls, he hung large-scale street maps of the cities where he would carry out the killings. London, Cairo, Washington. He rose early each morning and worked while Astrid slept. Then they spent 2 hours together, talking and planning, before she left for the bookshop at 10 o'clock. By the afternoon, the walls would close in on him, so he would borrow Astrid's appalling bicycle and pedal the narrow streets of the canal rings. He found an art supply shop, purchased a small watercolor kit, and produced several fine paintings of the bridges and the boats and the gabled houses overlooking the canals. On the fourth day,
a bitter cold front pushed in from the North Sea. For the next 2 days, the Krista was filled with the playful screams and shouts of hundreds of skaters gliding over the frozen surface of the Prinzendrach. Each evening, he would collect Astrid from the bookshop and take her to a different restaurant. Afterward, they would stroll the windswept canals and drink draconic beer in the cannabis-scented bars of the Leidsupline. She made love to him for 2 nights, then turned her back to him for the next 2. Her sleep was fitful, troubled by nightmares. On the night before their departure, she awoke in a panic, bathed in sweat. Grabbing for the small Browning automatic she habitually kept on the floor next to the bed. She might have blown off Delaroche's head had he not wrested the gun from her grasp before she could release the safety. She made frenzied love to him and begged him never to leave her. The following morning broke cold and gray. They packed in silence and padlocked the Krista. Delaroche destroyed his paintings. Astrid telephoned the bookshop. She had a family emergency and needed a few days off. She would be in touch. They took a taxi to the Zentralstation and caught the early morning train to the town of Hoek van Holland. They took another taxi to the ferry terminal and had a late breakfast of bread and eggs at a small waterfront cafe. 1 hour later, they boarded the car ferry for Harwich, across the North Sea in Britain. The passage usually took 6 hours in good weather, 8 or more when the seas turned rough. On that day, a cold winter storm pushed down from the Norwegian Sea. Astrid, who was prone to seasickness, spent much of the journey in the lavatory, violently ill, cursing Delaroche's name. Delaroche stayed outside on the observation deck in the glacier-scented air, watching the wind-driven rollers breaking across the prow of the ferry. Shortly before their arrival, Astrid altered her appearance. She pinned her blonde hair close to her scalp and covered her head in a black shoulder-length wig. Delaroche put on a baseball hat bearing the name of an American cigarette, and despite the weather, his Ray-Ban sunglasses. The European community makes the life of the international terrorist much easier, because once inside a member nation, travel to the others is almost free of risk. Delaroche and Astrid entered the United Kingdom on Dutch passports, posing as unmarried tourists, enduring only a cursory inspection of their travel documents by a bored British official. Still, Delaroche knew the British security forces routinely videotaped all arriving passengers, regardless of their passport. He knew he and Astrid had just left their first footprints. Night had settled over the English coastline by the time Delaroche and Astrid boarded the train at Harwich Station. 90 minutes later, they arrived in London. For his base camp, Delaroche chose a small service flat in South Kensington. He rented it for a week from a company that specialized in providing flats for tourists. His first act was to cancel the service aspect of the arrangement. The last thing he needed was a maid poking her nose into his things. The flat was modest but comfortable, with a fully functioning kitchen, a large sitting room, and a separate bedroom. The telephone line was direct, no switchboards involved, and there were large windows looking down onto the street. They wasted no time. The target was an MI6 officer named Colin Yardley, a 54-year-old former field officer who had served in the Soviet Union, the Mideast, and lately in Paris, and was now awaiting forced retirement in a dead-end head office desk job. He fit the profile of many intelligence officers at the end of their careers, burned out, bitter, divorced. He drank too much and put himself about with too many women. MI6 personnel had told him in no uncertain terms to knock it off. Yardley had told the flunkies in personnel to fuck off. It was all in Delaroche's report. Killing him would be easy. The challenge would be killing him the right way. Despite his years in the field, Yardley had grown lazy and careless now that he was back in London. Each evening he took a taxi from MI6's Riverside headquarters to a restaurant and bar in Sloane Square. It was there he did his hunting.
young girls attracted by his sturdy, gray, good looks. Wealthy West End divorcees, bored wives looking for a night of anonymous sex. He arrived a few minutes after 6 o'clock and took his usual seat at the bar. Astrid Fogel was waiting for him. She was not the same woman Dolaroche had seen in the Amsterdam bookshop 10 days earlier. She had spent the afternoon at Harrod's and the glittering shops in Bond Street, armed with a stack of Dolaroche's money. She now wore a black cocktail dress, black stockings, a gold watch, and a double strand of exquisite pearls around her throat. The simple black clasp was gone from her hair, which had been trimmed and blown out by a fussy Italian stylist at a salon off Knightsbridge. Now it fell dramatically about her face and neck. Astrid knew how to play down her natural good looks, but she also knew how to attract attention when necessary. Dolaroche sat on a bench in Sloane Square, pretending to read a copy of the Evening Standard, purchased from a newsstand outside the Sloane Square underground station. He watched the performance inside the restaurant as pantomime. Astrid sits at the bar alone, the eternal cigarette burning between her long, slender fingers. Yardley, tall, gray, distinguished, asks if the seat next to her is free. A drink appears before Yardley automatically, his regular, and by his expression, he thinks she is impressed by this. He gestures to the bartender to bring her another glass of white wine. Astrid, grateful, turns her body to face him, one long leg crossed suggestively over the other, her skirt riding high on her thigh. She belongs to him now. The frightened, lonely woman from the houseboat in Amsterdam is gone. She is a confident and cosmopolitan Dutch woman whose husband makes money and ignores her too much. And, yes, you can light my cigarette for me, darling. After an hour of this, she rises and puts on her coat. They shake hands formally. She allows her fingers to linger on his an instant too long. He asks her where she's staying. The Dorchester. Can he give her a lift? No, that's not necessary. Can he get her a taxi? No, I can manage. Could he see her again before she leaves London? Come back tomorrow night. And if you're very lucky, darling, I'll be here. She walked quickly across the square, passing Dolaroche, who was engrossed in his newspaper. She headed north, up Sloane Street. Dolaroche watched Yardley hail a taxi and disappear inside. He stood up and strolled across the square to Sloane Street. Astrid was waiting for him. How did it go? He would have fucked me right there at the bar if I'd let him. So he was interested. He asked me to come to his place for a drink and a takeaway curry. I told him my husband might be a little upset if I wasn't back at the hotel by the time his meeting was over. Good. I don't want him to think you're a whore. Besides, he can't be as stupid as he looks. What about tomorrow night? I left a strong impression I'd be back at the bar. He'll be back. Please, John Paul. I just don't want to kiss him. His breath smells like shit. That part of the operation is in your hands. God, I hope he doesn't try to kiss me. I swear, if he tries to kiss me, I'll kill him myself. Yardley arrived first the next night. Dolaroche, watching from his bench in Sloane Square, stifled laughter as the highly trained British intelligence officer cast a series of expectant glances toward the door. After half an hour, Dolaroche decided Yardley had waited long enough for his reward. He signaled Astrid, who was sitting in the window of a wine bar across the square. 5 minutes later, she was striding through the door of the restaurant, straight into the arms of Colin Yardley. She taunted him. She toyed with him. She hung on his every word. She ran her fingers through her hair. She allowed him to buy her too many glasses of Sancerre. She leaned forward so he could look down her blouse and see she was wearing no brassiere. She stroked the inside of his calf with the toe of her expensive Bruno Mali shoe.
She tried several times to leave. My husband will want to know where I am, darling. But he would signal the bartender, and another glass of Sancerre would arrive. And somehow, she just couldn't find the willpower to drag herself away from this terribly interesting man. And be a love, and get me another pack of cigarettes, please. Marlboro Light 100. Astrid the seductress. Astrid the needy. Astrid the silly, sex-starved Dutch tart, who would do anything for the attention of a middle-aged Englishman with a Savile Row suit and an expensive address. Delaroche admired her work from his vantage point in the square. He felt something else, a flash of tenderness. He reached inside his coat and felt for the butt of a Glock. The next part went according to plan. Astrid leaned forward and whispered in his ear. Yardley paid the check and collected their coats. 2 minutes later, they were climbing into a taxi. Delaroche watched them go. He rose and walked slowly after them, across Sloane Square, westward along the King's Road. He was not alarmed when the taxi disappeared from sight. He knew exactly where they were going, Yardley's home in Wellington Square. "Get him inside the house, Astrid. Tell him you're in a hurry. Tell him your husband will be crazy if you're gone too long. Take him straight to bed. Don't worry about the door. I'll take care of the door." Delaroche turned left off the King's Road and entered the stillness of Wellington Square. The noise of the rush hour traffic faded to a pleasant drone. A gentle rain began to fall. Delaroche walked quickly across the square, collar up, hands pushed deeply into his pockets. Yardley's house was dark, perfect. The front door lock provided little challenge, and after a few seconds, he was inside. He heard the sound of voices upstairs in the bedroom. Astrid had done her job well. When Delaroche entered the room, he found Yardley resting against the headboard, stripped to his shirt and his socks, masturbating while Astrid performed a slow striptease for him at the foot of the bed. For an instant, Delaroche actually felt sorry for the man. He was about to die a most humiliating death. Delaroche removed the Glock from the waistband of his trousers and stepped inside the room. Alarm registered instantly on Yardley's face. Astrid stopped dancing and stepped aside. Delaroche took her place at the end of the bed. Then his arm swung up, and he shot Colin Yardley rapidly 3 times in the face. The body tumbled from the bed onto the floor. Astrid stepped forward, kicked Yardley's head with the toe of Bruno Mali's shoe, and spit on his face. Astrid the revolutionary. Delaroche informed the management company that he would have to cut short his London vacation due to a family emergency. Before leaving the flat, he logged onto the laptop and sent a brief, encrypted message to his employers, informing them that the job had been carried out, and please wire the specified funds to the specified account in Zurich. He and Astrid took a late train to Dover and spent the night in a quaint seaside bed and breakfast. In the morning, they took the first ferry to Calais, where they hired a Renault car and drove northward along the Channel coast. By nightfall, they were back aboard the Christa on the quiet Prinsengracht in Amsterdam. The body of Colin Yardley was discovered early that afternoon as Delaroche and Astrid were passing from France into Belgium. MI6 personnel security became alarmed when he did not arrive for work and when repeated calls to his Wellington Square residence went unanswered. An MI6 team broke into the house shortly after 1 p.m. and discovered the body in the upstairs bedroom. The Metropolitan Police, however, were not informed of the death until 4:15. The BBC reported the shooting death of an unidentified man on its 9 o'clock news. By the time ITN went on the air at 10, the corpse had a name and a job. Colin Yardley, a mid-level Foreign Office clerk. During the program, a telephone call arrived at the news desk. The caller said the Provisional Irish Republican Army had carried out Yardley's murder. The caller provided the special recognition code to prove the claim was authentic. By morning, BBC reporters had uncovered Yardley's true occupation,
that he was a career member of the Secret Intelligence Service, MI6. Jean-Paul Delaroche listened to the BBC aboard the Krista. He switched off the radio when it was over, and then settled in with his maps and his computer, plotting the next killing. He telephoned Zurich. Herr Becker confirmed $1 million had been wired into the account that morning. Delaroche instructed him to transfer the money to 4 Bahamian accounts, $250,000 for each. The sun came out at midday. He borrowed Astrid's bicycle and spent the rest of the afternoon painting along the banks of the Amstel River, until the image of Yardley's exploded face was erased from his conscience. Chapter 20. McLean, Virginia. I don't know why Carter has to send you to London. Why the hell can't someone else go? Elizabeth had picked Michael up at headquarters and was driving him to Dulles Airport, 20 miles from Washington, on the western edge of Northern Virginia's suburban sprawl. It was 7 p.m. The rush hour was technically over, but traffic still jammed the Capitol Beltway. Elizabeth tended to tailgate when she was tense. As a result, they were riding 2 feet from the rear bumper of a hunter green Ford Explorer, traveling 45 miles per hour. I thought you talked to him about our situation, Michael. I thought he agreed to let you work from New York. I thought he was going to let you cut back for a couple of weeks. Michael thought, maybe I should have taken an agency car to the airport. The last thing he wanted to do was quarrel with his wife before boarding an international flight. He was not a superstitious man, nor was he a nervous flyer, just realistic. I'll only be a day, he said, over and back, with a couple of meetings in between. If it's so routine, why can't Carter send someone else? Elizabeth was not a litigator. She practiced law in the quiet of corporate shadows, but she was skilled at the art of cross-examination. She hammered on the horn. Michael knew he had just been declared a hostile witness. A British intelligence officer was murdered in London last night, Michael said calmly. It may have something to do with a case I've been working for a long time. I read about it in the Post this morning. The IRA claimed responsibility. Since when have you dealt with the IRA? I thought your portfolio was strictly Arab terrorism. It is. But we think there may be a tie-in. Michael hoped she would let it drop. The trip to London was his idea, not Carter's. Carter wanted the liaison work handled by an officer from London Station, but Michael convinced Carter to send him instead. In 2 days, I have my eggs harvested. At that time, they'll be fertilized with sperm. Hopefully, it will be yours, Michael. I'll be back, don't worry. And if something comes up, we've got an ace in the hole. On ice. Because of the nature of his work and the possibility of sudden mandatory travel, the doctors at Cornell Medical Center had recommended that some of Michael's sperm be frozen. Elizabeth said, I would like you there for emotional support, Michael. I thought you case officers were supposed to be good at that kind of thing. The least you could do is be there with me. I'll be there, I promise. Be careful what you promise, Michael. She exited the beltway, turning onto the Dulles Access Road. The traffic cleared away. Elizabeth accelerated to 65. A full moon hung over the Virginia countryside, shrouded behind a transparent layer of cloud. Michael lit a cigarette and cracked the window. Elizabeth drove aggressively, changing lanes without signaling, tailgating, flicking her high beams at anyone who dared to drive under 70 in the passing lane. Michael knew the real reason for Elizabeth's bad temper. He was going to London to investigate an act of terrorism, and she knew it would trigger thoughts of Sarah's murder. Her stubborn pride would not allow her to say it aloud, but it was written in the anxious expression on her face. She would be more upset if he told her the truth. He suspected Sarah and the British officer were murdered by the same man. Elizabeth said, I gave Tom Logan the material from Susanna's desk. Is he going to publish the piece? He says he can't, not without confirming all the details first. He says the allegations are too explosive to print without being reviewed by their lawyers.
and since the reporter who wrote it is now dead, there can't be a thorough review.
What's he going to do?
He's assigned a team of his best reporters to match the story. Unfortunately, Susanna's not going to be much help to them from the grave. Her notes don't contain many clues about the identity of her sources. So Logan's team has to basically start from scratch.
That could take a very long time.
It took Susanna 3 months to do it alone. They arrived at Dulles. Elizabeth drove to the departure level and pulled over to the curb. Michael climbed out and collected a lightly packed garment bag from the trunk. He closed it, then walked to the driver's side of the Mercedes. Elizabeth had let down the window and was leaning her head out, waiting for a kiss goodbye. Be careful, Michael.
I will.
He waited until her taillights vanished into the darkness, then he went inside the terminal. Michael came awake as the jetliner slipped below the cloud cover and descended into the gray London morning. London Station had offered to send a car, but Michael wanted as little to do with London Station as possible, so he took a taxi instead. He pulled down the window. The raw air felt good against his face, despite the stink of diesel fumes. London had been his home for 8 years. He had made the journey from Heathrow to central London 1,000 times. The dreary western suburbs sweeping past him were more familiar than Arlington or Chevy Chase. He checked into his hotel, a modest, independent establishment on Knightsbridge, overlooking Hyde Park. He preferred it because each room came with a small sitting room in addition to the bedroom. He ordered a full English breakfast and picked at it until it was late enough to phone Elizabeth. He awakened her, and they had a disjointed 2-minute conversation before she drifted back to sleep. Michael was tired, so he slept until early afternoon. When he awoke, he dressed in a waterproof jogging suit. He hung the Do Not Disturb sign on the door, and for insurance left a telltale, a tiny piece of paper wedged between the door and the jamb. If it was still there when he returned, it was likely the room had not been entered. If it was gone, someone had probably been there. He set out on the footpaths of Hyde Park under clouds the color of pewter, heavy with rain. 10 minutes into the run, the skies opened up. The Londoners rushing past beneath wind-blown umbrellas glared at him as though he was an escaped mental patient. After 15 minutes, his breath turned ragged, and he stopped to walk. Over the years, he had been able to maintain his physical fitness, despite being a moderate smoker. But now the cigarettes were taking their toll, and Elizabeth was right. He was getting thicker around the waist. He ran back to the hotel. The telltale fell to the floor as he opened the door to his room. He showered and changed into a blue business suit. He took a taxi to Grosvenor Square and flashed his identification to the Marine guard at the entrance. Michael felt uncomfortable in embassies. He was a knock through and through. When he was based in London, he came to the embassy only in emergencies and only black, meaning he arrived underground in the back of a van. He wished he didn't have to come at all, but center doctrine demanded a courtesy call to the local chief of station. The COS in London was a man named Wheaton, an unabashed Anglophile with a pencil-thin mustache, a Savile Row chalk-striped suit, and an annoying habit of toying with a tennis ball when he didn't know quite what to say. Wheaton was old school. Princeton, Moscow, 5 years as head of the Russia desk before scoring the plum career-ending assignment in London. He said he had known Michael's father, but he didn't say he liked him. He also made it clear he didn't think London Station needed any help from the CTC on this one. Michael promised to brief him on his findings. Wheaton politely told Michael he'd like him to get out of town as quickly as possible. The taxi dropped Michael at the White Georgian Terrace in Eaton Place. Helen and Graham Seymour owned a pleasant apartment, and from the street, Michael could see them like actors on a multi-level stage. Graham upstairs in the drawing room, Helen below street level in the kitchen. He descended the steps and rapped on the paned glass kitchen door. Helen looked up from her cooking and smiled broadly.
Opening the door to him, she kissed his cheek and said, "God, Michael, it's been too long." She dumped Sancerre into a goblet and thrust it into his hand. "Graham's upstairs. You boys can talk shop while I finish supper."
Graham Seymour was fidgeting with a gas fire when Michael entered the room.
It was wood-paneled and wood-floored, with an exquisite array of Oriental rugs and Middle Eastern decorations. Graham stood up, smiled, and stuck out his hand. They regarded each other as only men of identical size and shape can do. Graham Seymour was like Michael's negative. Where Michael was olive-complected, Graham was fair. Where Michael was dark-haired and green-eyed, Graham was blonde and gray-eyed. Michael wore a blue business suit. Graham was dressed for safari in khaki trousers and a khaki bush shirt. They sat down and talked about old times. They had lived nearly identical lives. Like Michael, Graham's father had worked in intelligence. MI5's double-cross operation during the war. Then MI6 for 25 years after that. Like Michael, Graham followed his father from posting to posting and joined the Secret Intelligence Service immediately after graduating from Cambridge. The two men had worked side by side over the years, though Graham always functioned under official cover. They had developed a professional respect and personal friendship. Indeed, they were closer than either of their services would prefer if they knew. The smell of Helen's cooking drifted upstairs into the drawing room. "What's she making?" Michael asked cautiously. "Paella," Graham said and frowned. "Perhaps you should run to the chemist's now before it closes." "I'll be all right." "You say that now, but you haven't had Helen's paella." "That bad?" "I don't want to spoil the surprise. Perhaps you should have some more wine." Graham went downstairs to the kitchen, returning a moment later with glasses filled with white Bordeaux. "Tell me about Colin Yardley." Graham grimaced. "Curious thing happened a couple of months ago.
A Lebanese arms dealer named Farouk Khalifa decided to set up shop in Paris.
He found out about it and notified our French friends. They put Mr. Khalifa under watch."
"That was nice of the French."
"He sells weapons to people we don't like."
"He's a bad man."
"He's a very bad man. He opens up the bazaar and starts receiving clients. The French photograph everyone who comes and goes."
"I get the picture."
"In September, a man calls on Mr. Khalifa. The French are unable to identify him, but they suspect he's a Brit, so they send us a copy of the photo by secure fax."
"Colin Yardley?"
"In the flesh."
End of side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.